On July 11th, 2007, a 31-year-old Karma Purpura is last seen getting into the cab of a truck at a rest stop near Indianapolis. The next day, a truck driver is arrested in Nashville under suspicion he's involved in the murder of another woman. Inside his cab, they find Karma's phone and credit card, and so much of Karma's blood, detectives are certain that Karma is no longer alive. 4 years later, a skull along with some other remains are found in Kentucky. With few clues to go on, she becomes one of the state's unidentified women. Even though it takes 5 more years to identify her as Karma, it brings some amount of resolution to her case. This is her story.
Hi, I'm Vanessa.
And I'm Amy.
And you're listening to She Goes By Jane.
At the end of this episode and every episode, we will be joined by a special guest who will read an original poem by Amy Baker about the women we're featuring. This week, we are joined by Jan Karam.
Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Amy.
So I promise this opening is going to connect a little bit in a second here. You and I were just at book club, which we go to once a month, and we read Amanda Gorman's book of poetry. It was a great discussion. But afterwards, you and I had a conversation, which I'm going to cycle back to because I was like, this actually connects with what we're talking about this week, which was we were talking about the ways in which, like, in depth, otherwise related, how suicide and drug addiction are treated. And you were saying about drug addiction.
Yeah. So to be clear, this has nothing to do with the actual book.
No.
This was just a side conversation we were having.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. So we were talking about, yes, suicide and addiction.
Mm-hmm. And what did what you were saying about addiction, to recap that conversation, like how it's treated by people.
Okay. So to recap, we were talking about how, like, when a person passes away, either through suicide or something drug-related, like particularly like an overdose, people tend to cover that up. Is that where you're going with that? They tend to cover it up. They tend to see it kind of almost like, and this is something that makes me sad every single time. It's something I don't agree with. And it almost makes it feel like their last moments on earth were an embarrassment. And I don't particularly see it that way. I see both dying of suicide or dying of something drug-related as dying of a disease. That's how I view it. So, yeah, so we were just having a conversation about that and how we should not be trying so hard to cover it up. It's not any different than dying of heart disease or cancer or anything else that a person has very little control over.
Right. And so we were having that conversation and I was like, well, that's perfect because the person that we're talking about today, who was both a missing and unidentified woman, you know, she struggled with drug addiction. That's not how she died, but that's a huge part of her story. And so we're going to approach that as compassionately as possible, even though some of the decisions that she made might not have been the best choices. But
when somebody is struggling, yes, it's very hard to make the best choices for yourself. So we'll give her some grace on those bad decisions.
Yes. So the story that we're talking about today first came to me as an unidentified woman. And then this is one of the first cases that I had written about that was solved. And so we're going to be talking today about Karma Purpura, who went missing in 2007. And she was also an unidentified woman who was found in 2011.
Okay, so when you first come across this case, she was unidentified.
Yes.
Okay.
And so now I know a lot more about her. And so I'm telling this story mostly chronologically and not in the order of how I learned about her and her story.
Okay. So when you knew about her, you would not have known about any of the choices she's made or any of these
things? I didn't know anything about her past, nor, you know, we have actually talked about quite a few cases recently that were tied to serial killers. And that's just like not really my jam, so to speak. Like, I'm not infinitely fascinated by serial killers. But in this case, it seems like this is what is happening here.
But again, when she was still unidentified, would you have known she was the result of a serial killer?
Nope.
No. So you did not seek that out. So
no.
Nobody's going to feel like, Like you have like a serial killer thing. Amy does not, for the record, have a thing for serial killers.
No.
No.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
I tend to avoid those, but yes.
So, as we all should.
Yeah. With the serial killers.
Yes.
Indeed, if we could only. So we're really going to start off. I'm going to start talking about karma's history as sensitively as possible, while also recognizing the complexity there.
And we should also take a minute to say how cool her name is.
It is a beautiful name.
It is. So it's Karma with a C, and it's really, really pretty.
Mm-hmm. Karma was born on August 19th, 1975, in Indianapolis, Indiana. I didn't find much information about Karma's early years, but it is clear she did have a teenage pregnancy and had a daughter. Now, Karma did have an arrest record as an adult. At some point, she'd faced some shoplifting charges as well as some drug charges. To me, it seems like she was really having like a rough go of it, so to speak. In 1999, she was 24 years old and had a 7-year-old daughter. Together, they lived with Karma's boyfriend, Brandon, who was 26. They lived in Gosport, Indiana, which is about an hour southwest of Indianapolis. From newspaper reports at the time, it's clear that Brandon and Karma were both using drugs.
Okay, so, and Brandon is not her daughter's dad.
No.
No, okay.
So this is where the story is going to get a bit complicated, but again, we're approaching this as compassionately as possible. On the night of June 7th, Karma's boyfriend, Brandon, seemed to be out with a friend, Neil, and at the very least an acquaintance called Gregory Reed. And at the very least, Neil and Gregory knew each other because they worked together at Donato's Pizza restaurant in Carmel. The three of them were in Broad Ripple, which is north of Indianapolis, and they drove all the way back to Brandon and Karma's home. It's a bit unclear if the reason Neil and Greg went to this home was to purchase or use drugs. There's a lot of opinions on both sides, but all four did use heroin and marijuana at the home. Allegedly, they did this in front of Karma's 7-year-old daughter. The four adults all finally fell asleep around 6 a.m., and just 4 hours later, it was reported that Karma's daughter finds Greg dead.
So is Greg an overdose?
Yes, at least that's what we can surmise.
Okay.
The three adults, likely not wanting to face repercussions for this death or drug use or the potential sale of drugs, decide to dump his body. Brandon drives Greg's body to a site near a communications tower on Observatory Road while Karma, Neil, and Karma's daughter follow in another vehicle. They then drive to Indianapolis, where they abandon Greg's car by a convenience store with the keys still in the ignition. Now, someone does actually steal this vehicle from the convenience store and abandons it in High Point, North Carolina, but it's not until September 20th, 1999 that Greg's body is found. He's found by two telephone workers who are working near the communications tower.
Okay, so at the beginning of this episode, you did warn us that there will be some choices made.
Yes.
Yes. So we are going to excuse the drug use portion of this, but please, friends, don't dump your friends' bodies somewhere when something happens.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really hard thing to think about because Karma is making some bad decisions here, and these bad decisions have been harmful to other people. So, you know, Karma will become a missing person, but she is also responsible for someone else's child
going missing. Yeah. So some of those things are a little harder to like excuse, especially probably for some of our listeners, but we will, I guess, put those feelings aside because we are talking about her disappearance, right? More than the things she's done.
You know, and I think like this provides some context and also highlights, you know, how complex some of these cases are. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about how much, like, we often demand perfection of missing persons before mm-hmm. we enact care. But we can enact care for Greg, who was missing, who, you know, was at this house.
And deserves some
care and respect. And we can also demand care and respect for Karma as well.
Right, because I'm sure the things that are about to happen to her are also not okay.
Like, right.
You know?
And even if that hadn't happened to her, understanding the complexity of of drug use and drug abuse and addiction is part of this conversation. Like, that was extremely harmful and detrimental to another family.
Right. And like you said, people do, we all kind of cling to like these stories of like, oh, we want to talk like about how fantastic every single person that has anything horrible happened to them is. I think there's like a meme going around of like, I don't light up a room, so I'll probably never go missing, right? Or something. To that effect. I don't know it word for word, but like we've had that discussion before. Not every person who goes missing is the kind that lights up a room.
Yeah. But you know, like for many people, karma did.
Probably, right? Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So she's deeply loved by her family. And, you know, Greg was also deeply loved mm-hmm. by his family.
Right. I think I'm still stuck with like, ooh, Greg.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll continue listening to
what happened.
What happens.
So one of the people who was there and was involved in this, Neil, he comes forward pretty quickly and he takes a plea deal in exchange for providing information. He reveals what happened that night and also reveals that Karma's boyfriend, Brandon, has been threatening him. Like the don't talk kind of threats. Both Karma and Brandon are arrested and charged with felony obstruction of justice, auto theft, and improper disposal of a body. In January of 2000, Brandon pled guilty on those charges, which left both him and Neil to testify against Karma. Now, that's not to say that she was the more guilty party here. It's just that they took a deal while she was still thinking about facing a trial instead. Unfortunately, she was arrested again in April of 2000 for operating a motor vehicle while intoxicated and possession of heroin. As a result of this arrest, her bond was revoked, sending her back to jail. Though she had been searched before going into jail, she somehow managed to leave a needle inserted in her arm. And a deputy noticed this because there was blood on the wall in Karma's cell. They found her in possession of drug paraphernalia and heroin, and she was charged with possession of drugs and paraphernalia. In exchange for dropping the intoxication and possession of heroin charges, Karma pled guilty to obstruction of justice and auto theft in the case regarding Greg's death. She was sentenced to 4 years, suspended except for 2 years, and 4 years probation. Plus, she had to pay Greg's family $475 for damages done to his car. Now, Indiana at the time had a 2-for-1 sentencing deal working, which meant that Karma was to be released from jail on June 20th, 2001. Instead, she was released from Morgan County Jail on December 18th, 2000, a good 6 months early. It really seems like upon her release, she was trying to get her stuff together. She was working full-time at a restaurant and paying child support to her daughter's father, who at that point had custody. She was attending counseling sessions and going to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings and Narcotics Anonymous meetings. She also was starting to do art again, which seemed to be a passion of hers. Despite this, the prosecutor, Steve Sonega, wanted her back in jail to serve the remainder of her sentence, arguing that the early release had been accidental. Her lawyer tried to argue on her behalf, but she was sent back to jail by Judge Jane Spencer Craney. From then on, she seemed to struggle even more. She was charged with a probation violation in 2003, and in 2006, she was arrested for possession of syringes and other items used to inject heroin. Somewhere in there, I'm guessing around 2005, she also had her second daughter. It's very clear that Karma is struggling at this point of her life, and there's a bit about her in Ginger Strand's book, Killer on the Road.
Okay, and we've mentioned Ginger Strand on the podcast before.
Yeah, so she was on our Bitter Creek Betty episode as our poetry reader, and we mm-hmm. referred heavily to her book, Killer on the Road, because that case deals specifically with the interstate system, truck drivers, serial killers. It's a brilliant and wonderful book.
So I can go ahead and guess that this is going to have something with something that pertains to her book then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So Ginger, she spoke to Clark Fine, who was a detective in Hendricks County, which is west of Indianapolis. He'd been investigating the murder of a woman involved in sex work named Buffy Browley. And during his investigative work, had spoken to Karma. Now, Buffy was murdered in 2004, and her killer confessed to the murder in 2006. So this conversation took place somewhere between those two dates. Detective Fine found Karma at a truck stop. She was using truck stops to do sex work. And Detective Fine warned her, saying, "This is a dangerous life." And Karma said, "I know, but I gotta make a living."
Was he right?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, but is this what led to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, because not long after that, Karma disappeared. On July 11th, 2007, Karma was caught on an ATM surveillance camera. She was seen wearing a multicolored flowered shirt. A truck stop employee at the Flying J near the interchange of I-465 and Indiana 37 would later say he noticed her near a truck. That's the last time anyone would see Karma alive again. The next day, July 12th, police in Nashville would arrest a truck driver under the suspicion he murdered a woman named Sarah Nicole Hulbert a month earlier. Inside his truck, they would find Karma's cell phone, her ATM card, and a receipt belonging to her. They would also find a blouse that looked similar to the one that Karma was wearing in the ATM surveillance footage. The man had blood on his hands, under his fingernails, and there was a large amount of blood in his cab. They determined that some of this blood belonged to Karma, and they determined that through a DNA test that linked her to her parents. During questioning, the truck driver said that there was a woman who had been shot in the back of the head at the Flying J truck stop in Indianapolis, and that he left her body in a vehicle at the Hardee's on Harding Street.
So did they find a vehicle at the Hardee's on Harding Street, or?
Yeah, this is like a really weird story, right? And the investigators think this is like pretty far-fetched.
Right. Like, how would this have happened, and how would he just know about?
Well, like, you know, in this case, how has this not been noted? Like, you left it in someone's vehicle and no one's called it in and said there's...
Well, he said there was a woman that was shot in the back of the head. He didn't say he did it, right?
Yeah, we're going to get into that a little bit later.
Okay, so far, Karma's missing.
Yes.
And all of this stuff is in his truck.
Yeah, and you know...
And then he's saying this weird story.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he's saying this weird story. Karma's missing. Just the idea that, like, he was arrested the day after she disappeared just, like, crushes me. Like,
so is Karma really going to end up, like, is she a missing woman and is she going to be one of those cases where she's a missing woman and an unidentified body and at some point the two get connected? Because we've talked about that before, how, like, you know, there's the two parts of the puzzle and it's like getting those two together. So
right. So this is one of those cases where the puzzle pieces will eventually fit together. But at this point in time, investigators are like, hey, what we know is this man has said he left her body in a car by the Hardee's. They go and look for her for 3 days. They're looking at the Hardee's, the Flying J. They're looking at all these places in between. Unfortunately, both Hardee's and the Flying J used a trash service that disposed of trash using incinerators. So when they don't find Karma, one of the main theories was that her body had been unintentionally sent to one of those waste disposal incinerators.
Those waste disposal incinerators seem like a dangerous thing in this kind of situation.
Right.
Like,
yeah, so this is like, you know, how does that happen? Well, like, this is how it happens. But, you know, there's been other cases in which it's likely that someone's body is in a landfill and there's no information or they can't find them at the landfill. At the time, the spokesman for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office said, "It's doubtful that a body will ever be found. We're confident that we can make a case without the body, but it will take quite some time. This will be decided in months, not weeks." Now, as we've already established, I don't like talking about serial killers necessarily, or about, like, what they did or what their process was, but we have to get into it for this story. The only positive I can say is that when I first heard his name, like, immediately exited my brain. Like, I can't actually tell you his name off the top of my head right in this moment. And he is not someone I hear mentioned a lot, at least by name, so I'm happy to keep it that way for this episode.
Okay.
Now, on July 12th, 2007, the day after Karma went missing, Detective Pat Postiglione arrives at the Travel Centers of America outside of Nashville because he's been combing through surveillance footage trying to find out what happened to Sarah Nicole Hulbert. Sarah was a 25-year-old woman whose body was found behind a truck stop on June 26th. She had been sexually assaulted and then shot and killed. Detective Pat Postiglione began looking for a specific truck that he thought might be connected to the case. So when he spots it back in Nashville, this is his break. I guess he approached the truck driver and said something like, "Are you the one we're looking for?" And though the truck driver seemed nervous during his questioning, he did grant them permission to search his truck. When they search his truck, they find Karma's belongings, but there's also other evidence inside. This included a bag of clothes with blood on them, and later they learned through testing they come from 10 different individuals.
I'm curious as to why he would just be like, "Oh yeah, go ahead, search me."
Yeah, it is strange.
Yeah, that wasn't going to end well.
No, particularly because apparently there is quite a lot.
Is there more stuff in there?
There is. So there's numerous gun cartridges, a rifle, a nightstick, latex gloves, handcuffs, razor blades, electrical tape, sex toys, and about 300 other pieces of evidence, along with what has been described as a lot of blood evidence. He was immediately taken into custody.
Yeah.
Ultimately, they linked him to Sarah Nicole Hulbert's death. During questioning, he also implicated himself in the murder of Samantha Winters. Samantha, who was 48 and living in Nashville, was found shot to death and placed in a trash can at a truck stop in Lebanon, Tennessee. She was found on June 6th, so that was before Sarah. He also implicated himself in the murder of Lucille Carter. Lucille went by the name Gretna and was 44 when she was shot and killed. Her murder took place between Sarah and Karma's, and her body was found on July 1st in a trash bin along a roadside in Birmingham, Alabama.
Now, one of the things I don't like when we talk about serial killers is these long lists.
Yes.
It's uncomfortable to, like, when you just start and you just keep going with, like, all of these names and all these people, because it's a lot.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So, like, every time we say one of these names, that's an individual person. And those are families and friends, right, and, you know, coworkers and other loved ones who are, like, connected.
Destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By this.
Yeah.
So, around this time, in terms of questioning, he stops talking, but it's clear that he was particularly targeting women in the sex industry. To most people, he would seem like your average guy. But Detective Pat Postilione says, "He's a piece of work. He had no criminal record. He had a wife who died while he's been in prison. In fact, he's accused me of killing her, and he has two daughters and a son. He even ran for mayor of Albion, Illinois."
So the truck driver has run for mayor?
Yeah, so he ran for mayor in 1997, and he received only 48 votes compared to his competitors, who each had over 400 votes apiece. Mm-hmm. His campaign seemed to mostly stem from his anger with the city for telling him he needed to remove junk cars from his property. So maybe that loss isn't too surprising.
No. I think it's also kind of funny that he's blaming the detective for his wife's death.
Yeah.
Like, who does that?
This guy.
This guy.
This guy.
This guy.
He's very much a nothing is my fault kind of guy. Now, even though Karma's body hadn't been found, they did believe it was possible to move forward in a case against him. The first step in this was on April 8th, 2008. This was when Dr. Bruce Levy, the medical examiner for the state of Tennessee, submitted that it was his opinion, based on the amount of blood and the location of blood on Karma's blouse, that she could not have survived the attack. 2 days later, the truck driver was charged with Karma's murder. In 2010, he went to trial for the murder of Sarah Hulbert. While in jail awaiting trial, he tried to hire fellow inmates to kill three witnesses who were scheduled to testify against him. For this, he was willing to pay $15,000 to each of those inmates. He was convicted of this and sentenced to 30 years. Now, Karma's family went to Nashville and attended the trial for the murder of Sarah Hulbert. Predictably, there were a lot of criticisms about Sarah's life during the trial, but in the closing arguments, the prosecuting attorney said of Sarah, "She had a right to live, she had a right to change her life, and raise her children." Now, I really rarely give much space for the things killers say about their crimes, but Vanessa, you seem interested by some of the facts that have been put forth so far. About how he didn't specifically say.
Right. How the woman had just been shot in the head.
Yes.
That part. Mm-hmm. The woman had been shot in the head, but he didn't say by me or by so-and-so.
Right.
That's a weird way of wording it.
It is a very weird way. So The reason that I'll bring it up is to kind of answer that question. So during this trial, they play a tape of the truck driver being questioned by Detective Postillon. In it, the truck driver talks about how he drove from Indianapolis to Nashville. So this is in the case of Sarah, when he stopped to get a sandwich.
Okay.
And he says that there, two men came up to him and asked him where he was going. And he claimed that he knew these men and one of them got into his truck. Then the second one got in and he said that he had to stop at another truck stop because he'd forgotten to get his sandwich. He hoped while he was gone, both men would leave. But when he got back, though, they had killed a woman in his cab.
While he went to get a sandwich.
Yes.
The sandwich that he was stopping to get when the guys got in. So they're basically the, like, murder fairies.
Yes.
And they just swooped in and committed murder while he was getting a sandwich.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Sounds believable.
He claims that they told him that this murdered woman was his problem now and just left.
How dare they?
How dare. Well, his claim extends from there. He says that they'd done this before and that they, quote unquote, do it all the time.
And he keeps falling for it and just like letting them stay in his truck while he goes and gets sandwiches?
I guess. Yeah.
Mister.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. For the murder of Sarah Hulbert, he was sentenced to life in prison.
We'll be back in a moment.
You might be surprised to know that not all serial killers are straight, cisgender white men. And the victims of true crime are not a monolith either. She's Wendy and I'm Beth. And together we host Fruit Loop's Serial Killers of Color, a true crime podcast.
Together we take deep dives into the true crime stories about marginalized and minoritized perps and victims that often go untold.
We also provide the context and nuance that these stories deserve. At Fruit Loops, we're serving up true crime with a side of history, society, culture, and some fun.
Listen to Fruit Loop Serial Killers of Color on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Bill Huffman, and I am a former Cleveland news producer, and I am now the host of the podcast Who Killed? I began the show focusing on the unsolved murder of Amy Mihaljevic, and now each week I explore a different case with a focus on some of the victims who don't get the attention they deserve. I have a deep catalog of over 225 episodes, so there is a guarantee there will be something for you. Who Killed is an Evergreen Podcasts, Killer Podcasts, and Slow Burn Media production. Subscribe today wherever you get your favorite shows.
So now we're arriving at the part of this that I heard first, and that's how an unidentified body was found on August 15th, 2011. She was found on the eastbound shoulder of the Louis B. Nunn Parkway, otherwise known, I think, as the Cumberland Parkway, in Barron County, Kentucky. So there are two somewhat different stories about how she was found. One is that just after dawn, some state workers who were doing some spraying to get ready for some road construction found her skull. And the second is that her skull was found by some students scouring the woods looking for a rare tree. Either way, it's important to note that the terrain here is densely filled with grasses and scrub and trees, making it remarkable that she was found. Once her skull was located, Kentucky State Police returned to the area to search for more remains. They were joined by anthropology students from Western Kentucky University. Now, most of the remains that were recovered were found scattered in a wooded area about 100 to 120 feet apart. It's believed that because they were down an embankment, that her body had been left at the top of the embankment closer to the parkway and that they washed down at some point. In total, they were able to locate 30 bones by October of that year. And though not all of her teeth were found, there were enough to do a partial dental record. They noted that she had root canals and had at least two alloy fillings. They thought she could have been placed there anywhere between 1999 and 2010, so 1 to 15 years prior. Nearby was a floral bikini top that looked like it could have been connected to her based on the weathering to the top.
So does this story check out? Like, does it look like she's been shot?
Well, her cause of death is pretty apparent. She had a bullet hole in her skull.
Okay. So it does check out with his
well, part of his story.
Right.
Yes.
But that left who she was and who had killed her a mystery, and the police didn't have any leads. Dr. Emily Craig of Georgetown, Kentucky, who worked with the National Missing and Unidentified System, or NAMIS, determined that she was tall, standing between 5'9 and as tall as 6'1. She also said it was likely that the woman was Native American. Specifically, Dr. Craig told reporters that there are features in the bones that have the racial characteristics. We're pretty sure of her ancestry. How she self-identified, we don't know.
Was Karma Native American?
You know, it's not clear from any of the information that I have whether or not she was or identified as such. Now, there are no federally recognized tribes in Kentucky, but there are plenty of people of Native American descent living in Kentucky. Still, with no one coming forward, investigators believe that she was from outside the area. Which brings us to one of the main theories they had about this unidentified woman and how she was murdered. And I'm going to pause here to clarify that there is some racism present in the statements. But
this does not come from Amy.
No, this does not represent
these are quotes.
My views, right? Okay. So the first is not. It's that Dr. Craig and a team of anthropologists determined that the markings on the victim's skull indicated that she could have been scalped.
Okay.
It was surmised by investigators then that given that they thought she was Native American, that this could have been a hate crime.
Okay.
Okay. So.
Okay.
But then the detectives on this case made public statements about this, and I'm just going to quote him here for accuracy. He said, Mexican drug cartels are known for beheading and scalping people in turf wars south of the border, though that kind of brutality has yet to be seen in rural Kentucky. And then someone who wasn't even actively involved in this case, but who covered the area as part of the Drug Enforcement Administration, weighed in and said, I'm not saying there's no connection tying violence here to the cartels. I'm just saying we can't do it at this point. So we really want to highlight here that even though there was no evidence tying this to quote-unquote Mexican drug cartels, and even though there's no indication that Mexican drug cartels were part of this part of Kentucky, and even though the act of scalping is not specific to the cartels, they just decided to publicly state these things for the record.
Are they doing it because, as they quoted back here, that kind of brutality doesn't happen in rural Kentucky? Are we trying to put it off on, like, another group of people? Like, it can't possibly be someone from here.
Well, I mean, I think, like, this is some particular, like, white people fear-mongering. Mm-hmm. I was actually interested in, like, so I took a look at the population of Kentucky, like, its racial makeup. It is predominantly white identifying. But the Hispanic and Latin population has dramatically risen, statistically speaking, over the course of, like, what would have been part of these years, mm-hmm. right? So I just feel like this is part of fear-mongering and the othering of people, right? Like, how do you make people a little bit more afraid of those populations of people?
By telling them that they'll scalp you.
Right.
Scared.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so, yeah, again, that's what they decided to go on record saying. Now, the history of scalping is actually quite complicated and nuanced, and I think there's a long-held belief in the United States that this practice originated with Native Americans, but there's actually a long history of it throughout Europe and segments of Asia that predates white colonial presence in America. I don't usually comment on the poem that we include at the end because we have a special segment for our Patreon supporters called Behind the Poem, where we discuss things like this. But the poem at the end is written for Karma, but I wrote it in 2014 when she was unidentified. And so one of the main concerns here was about this potential scalping, right? And so there's these interjections into the main narrative of that poem by pieces of history surrounding scalping, particularly from those of European descent. So when you listen to the reading of the poem at the end, that's what you're experiencing.
Okay.
So even though investigators weren't making any headway on who murdered her, there were steps being taken to identify her. In 2011, at least some of her remains were sent to the University of North Texas for DNA analysis. I'm not clear if they got a good sample from this, but it yielded no matches. Thankfully, Kentucky law prohibited the cremation of remains from unclaimed or unidentified bodies. So when they tested again in 2016 using bone samples, they were able to identify her. In October of 2016, they were finally able to identify her as Karma Purpura.
So would you have heard in 2016 then that this poem that you wrote had been identified, like the person in it had been identified?
Yes.
Yeah. Were you surprised when you like actually got to see who Karma is and like her story?
Yeah, I mean,
because it doesn't quite match what
at all.
It does, like in this case, like just the unidentified woman's story that they made doesn't match Karma's story, like the disappearance story. So like the two pieces, the only way that this could have been solved is through DNA, right? Because like,
right,
these stories are so wildly different, you on know, what could have happened.
I think on Karma's side, what's interesting is that they had last presumed that it was likely she had been incinerated,
mm-hmm.
and that her body might never be found. And that's what they were operating from. So I will actually say huge kudos to investigators who still like put her DNA in mm-hmm. a place that could be searched and matched, even with that assumption that that's what happened. So I think that's really great, because I think like what happens sometimes is we get locked in, or investigators, also like podcasters like us, get locked in an idea of what happened
mm-hmm.
and can't see beyond that. And I worry that, like, that's what shaped the initial investigation into who this unidentified woman was, because that story that was crafted there did not match up.
So, and then going back to what you said earlier, so do some states actually allow the cremation of remains? Like, talking about, like, these things, like, we should be keeping this DNA as evidence, but now what happens when it gets cremated?
Right. I mean, I think this is actually something interesting that I hadn't thought about earlier. It really is state by state. So actually, I encourage you who are listening to actually investigate what your state's laws might be. So the problem is that who is responsible for unclaimed or unidentified bodies? And each state and locality is going to have their specific laws. Some states will allow the cremation of remains for an unclaimed person, meaning that they know who the person is. They okay. actually also might know who their relatives might be, but those relatives are not coming to claim and handle the body. Unclaimed,
but we know who it is.
Right.
What about in a case like where it's unidentified? Would they take DNA and then cremate it, or would they just not cremate it?
So also depends by the state.
Okay. So, some places, so like New York State, for example.
New York State, I believe, is in the clear, right? But other states allow for cremation. The problem is that who is responsible for holding the remains or handling them after, mm-hmm. right? Are they buried? Are they held in evidence? Are they in, you know, a medical examiner's office? Are they in a funeral home's office, right? Like, it will vary from place to place. And what I read is that some funerary directors are actually against the keeping of remains because they often incur expenses for that
okay.
that are not properly reimbursed, and that cremation actually is the most cost-efficient way of handling this. And so it's like this actually yeah. very interesting landscape that I wasn't really aware of. So if you are interested in what your state is doing, I encourage you to look it up. And also look up to make sure that those programs are funded enough so that, you know, if it does go to a funeral home, that they're not incurring massive costs because of it.
Yeah, I think it's just something we don't think about.
Yeah. So when the truck driver was told, though, that Karma was identified, he seemed surprised.
He did?
Yeah.
Like, why?
So, well, I'm not sure what happened between the time Karma was murdered and when her body was left behind on the Louis B. Nunn Parkway or the Cumberland Parkway. He said she was shot in Indianapolis, and he then was arrested the next day in Nashville, Tennessee. The parkway is not a destination connecting these two points, so it's possible that he would have had to detour to this location.
So how did she get there?
Yeah, so it seems like that her being left there was very intentional and likely thought this would
throw us off, like.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then, of course, there's the whole story of her being left in a car at the Hardee's, mm-hmm. right? So it seems like there was some evidence to cover up where she might be. In March of 2018, the truck driver was convicted of first-degree murder and abuse of a corpse in the killing of Samantha Winters. In 2021, it looks like he was relocated to Indiana to get ready for trial in Karma's murder, but it doesn't look like that has happened yet.
What if there were two other people involved? Is that a possibility, or has there been no evidence of that?
There's really, like, no.
There's none? Okay.
No.
Because then I was just like, maybe somebody helped him or worked with him.
Yeah, it really doesn't seem to be the case. Yeah. So I really want to close this episode with some statements from Karma's mom and the detective, Pat Postiglione, who worked on these cases. Of Karma's killer, her mom told reporters, "Judgment on his actions will come not from us or from the bench, but from God. Our hearts go out to both his family and the families of his other victims." I have, like, so much compassion for Karma, and I think drug addiction and the choices that people sometimes make because of those addictions sometimes make it hard to see the person there. And I think that's the case with Karma, who was clearly well-loved by her family. Which is why Pat Postiglione said of Karma, "She was a beautiful girl who got addicted to drugs that just took over her life." And then Karma's mom again said, "Despite her troubled life, we know Karma as a beautiful, talented, and sweet young woman."
We are now going to listen to Amy's poem, "Go Rome," read by Jan Karam. Jan Karam is a comedian, writer, actor, and artist. Her numerous TV credits, stand-up performances, and series acting roles include repeat performances on both The Tonight Show and The Late Show with David Letterman, HBO's legendary 13th annual Young Comedians Show, How to Live with Your Parents for the Rest of Your Life, Comics Unleashed, The Arsenio Hall Show, Norm, Mad About You, Politically Incorrect, Dr. Katz, and many others. She was a regular sketch player in The Carol Burnett Show, and in the now classic episode of Seinfeld, The Switch, Jan played Sandy, the one who never laughed. She can also be seen in Curb Your Enthusiasm. Jan's critically acclaimed hand-painted solo show, Reclining Nude on La Cienega, was recently produced and recorded for broadcast. As a filmmaker, her inimitably mischievous perspective is quite naturally enhanced in Under the Big Moo Moo, as it quirkily explores the universal agonies of seeking motherly approval. As a stand-up comedian, Jan headlines nationwide and regularly tours with Dana Carvey. She's released 3 successful comedy albums and taped her own documentary special, Beyond the Set.
Go, Rome. Unidentified woman discovered August 15, 2011, near Glasgow, Kentucky. When the Scythians came, their bodies and mounts laced with sweat, the plain birds would go silent. These men, fed from horse blood, scalps hanging from their reins. And I, in my dawn, heard the whippoorwill's last calls through the sycamore trees. No jangle of horse flesh or rye of sweat along this highway, just the lonely cries of whippoorwill and the snap of a plastic bag caught in the underbrush. When the Visigoths came, those wandering warriors set across battlefields with swords drawn, there in written law, the decalvatio, or separation of hair, skin, and skull. And I, delivered to this barren land, know the distance separating earth and sky, a finger's length shimmer rising on the road, the humid breath of semis passing the horizon in one tight, hot fist. When John Lovewell came, his frost-hued men at his heels. The ponds were still with ice, and the bodies of men killed. Their cured skins returned for bounty. And I, with a slice of a knife across the ridge of my brow, have forgotten the taste of snowflakes on my tongue, the whisper of ice on my lips, and the worn-out press of boots against snow. Here it's just the slow drop of blood on blood. When Bloody Bill Anderson's soldiers came, their horses pounding through Missouri and Kansas, the world fell away in one blue reckoning, slapping against the sides of their desperate creatures, the scalps of victories.
For more information about our show or to check out other shows on the network, please visit evergreenpodcast.com. Bye, Vanessa.
Bye, Amy.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
You're listening to Stop the Killing podcast. Join us as we take you behind the crime scene tape to explain global mass shootings and mass attacks. I'm Sarah Ferris, but more importantly, this is Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
I spent 5 years as the FBI's top executive looking for answers to the mass shooting crisis. I've been at the shooting scenes, I've traced heroic acts of bravery, and I've sat silently and listened to the heart-wrenching stories from survivors.
Amongst this horror, there is hope. We all hold the key to stop the killing. You just need to know how to unlock the door. Download Stop the Killing and be part of the solution. Search Stop the Killing on Apple, Spotify, and all the usual suspects.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence. And give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.